Let's see, my attempt today would be finish this puzzle. Of course, let me try to see you. Rigorously, we're gonna see the hope to finish the puzzle. And I will spend the next two lectures, one lecture and a half, a bit, to convince us that the hope, it becomes a reality. So if you wanted a goal, the goal is to see the hope and complete the reality. So when I put this puzzle here, there's some numbers, just like the first three lectures and the fourth lecture. Is that what did we so far get? Basically, out of all this group theory stuff, it's hard work. We have states. I mean, in the point of view of the canonical quantization, you'd be like, okay, game over. This is my states. I quantized. I have no idea what I quantized, but this is the results. Right, it's quantized. And you're asking, what did you quantize? I have no idea, but the states are like here. And then the next we do is actually what we did in the tutorial. You see, well, there's a state. Someone said this yesterday, I don't remember who, but it says, but it's the same as what Weinberg said. Weinberg says, you have a Hilbert space. Then between this and this, there gotta be an operator connect them. And that operator gets named to be creation operator. And it's very rightfully named. Look, there is no particle, it creates the particle. And yesterday I had a very philosophical tutorial that trying to convince you that's enough, right? Not only it's enough, you can say there's some A Dagger. Let me do it properly. I even make a picture of this. Let me do it properly. Here, properly. So everything is nicely labeled. And there is momentum, there's spin, and there's momentum, and there's spin. And we will always ignore the other label called the particle spaces for all our argument that doesn't come into play. As long as you realize if it's the same spaces, you have some photonic fermion mixing coming into play, that's fine. So that's what we say in tutorial. And then you, like in the tutorial, we say, well, that's enough. After you define this thing, well, you have to define this thing acting on even more particles, but similar idea. You have this thing, there's something connecting them. It's a creation operator. You define all the matrix element, it's defined.
Yang, I have a question.
Yeah.
I always heard that, you know, when we wanna like claim if we know a particle, we should know about its spin and its mass. But, you know, the label that we are using here.
So that's what that normally stands for. So particle spaces will tell us the mass. And that's our conclusion, actually, of the first homework, is you find something commutes with everybody. If it commutes with anybody, it will be a very good label. And that thing you found is called P squared. And turns out the eigenvalue of P squared is, of course, M squared. So that's the label that, yes, there's always a mass. And actually, the reason I can write this with an arrow is because we know the mass and then we know the relative equation. So I claim P0 is not independent because of the mass. Very good. Yes. Clearly, we are yes, that's right. You'd like, if you heard about states, you want to label it with, it always have a mass, which is nice. It's even Lorentz invariant. So appropriate for this course, right? But normally we kind of using this to indicate there is a specific mass for this particle. And we suppose, so that's when we don't write the mass and we don't write the P0 for the same reason. Well, P0 is like some combination of this and the mass. So, conclusions is, well, this is enough. I know some creation operator, and if I just take an adjoint, By then, well, we have no right to take it as the annihilation operator. But in this specific case, I hope you in the tutorial say that if you take an adjoint of this, what comes out of the thing when it acts on some multiple particle state, what did that thing do is really trying to kill a particle, which is annihilation. And then further, even better, and I ask you to calculate the commutator relationship. So I'm saying from this, you can calculate this. From this, you can calculate this. This is very abbreviated. I should have kept track of all the indices, but hopefully you know what I meant. And you were like, wait, this is exactly the one we've seen in field theory. But, oh, the first thing I should see is so far, for all the lecture tutorial homework, there is no field. We have not introduced the field yet. What we're trying is to push these two puzzles together, quantum mechanics and special relativity. More like special relativity says, I demand this, quantum mechanics. Okay, here you go. and then special relativity, I demand this, here you go. We'll come back to that story a little bit. But as the storyteller, and this is time I said, wow, this is actually really awesome. Because not only you have this, and the special relativity will just be laughing at it. It says, No, X is not even an operator. What do you mean by XP, right? There's special relativity, this guy is gone. And then, of course, then there's new people coming and says, I'm going to make an analogy of that thing that doesn't exist and depend all my theory on this thing. Seems even worse. No, but we know, in the end, somehow the field sneaks in, and that's where we're going today. So, the other thing we see is hopefully something you have seen before, which is our scattering matrix with some derivation. We figure out it's going to look like this, which is the same, really, as what you're seeing in the quantum mechanics course. And it is because of staring at this, special relativity is I'm not happy. And that's where the locality first sneak in, says, well, I don't know if these field things exist, but your Hamiltonian needs to be a density. Otherwise, where is the special relativity? Here. And the special relativity sneaks attack again. Says, look, you're time ordering things. I don't like time ordering in special relativity. You are ordering things. But sometimes it cannot be ordered because there's space-like separation. All these things. And so he demands that your Hamiltonian density exists and has to commute to each other so that when time ordering come in, all those commutations vanish. And I think that's where we ended. And the goal of the first half is to compute this guy.
Do you mean goal of the first half of the lecture or goal of the
first half of the lecture? It just like before break, we want to compute that. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about time ordering part. So one of the things is when they're space-like separated, they can't be time ordered. So the commutators should vanish. That is the requirement. Uh-huh. The other requirement is time ordering requires a notion of time against which the events are ordered. Uh-huh. So we're choosing a special privileged time. Shouldn't that be a problem for our special relativity as well? Like, what are we ordering the operators with respect to? What reference frame are we ordering them with respect to? Because if we boost, for example, the time order might change.
Well, That's right. But if you're boosted, you can change it because it's commutator.
But when we see an object like this in QFT, then how do we compute it?
We're not in QFT, right? We're not in QFT. We're in quantum mechanics, states, operator, states. There's no field theory yet. And if you ask, how do you compute it in QFT? And that's what Dan taught you. This is the Dyson formula. And then you have some amount of diagrams and divide it by all the bubble diagrams, and you have some other things to do. But there's no quantum field theory. You're not here. There's purely quantum mechanics. So I said the tutorial was ended in some place, and the rest are just brainstorming. So let's go over there. Says, so why, how do we compute this? We know this. This you have done in your tutorial. This one is easier. This one, a bunch of creation operators acting on that because it's free. And this is similar, creation operators, except it's acting on left vacuum. What's this? This is that thing we don't know how to compute. So what Weinberg comes out and make a claim, and I hope it's okay, I don't want to copy that. So you have seen it in your tutorial, right? It shouldn't be like, oh, what is this? No, you've seen it. Like, you might not finish the problem because it's just brainstorm. And all I want is you have seen this and acknowledge that the claim is for any operator. It is a expansion of some creation operator. And look at this, and Weinberg did a sneakily normal ordering. But that's fine, because you have a commutator. You know how to do normal ordering. So that's the claim. So the first step is any operator in quantum mechanics is completely equivalent to a bunch of matrix elements. If you know every single matrix element of the operator, you know the operator. And then when we're going to make this claim. Okay. When we're going to make this claim, and it says, I can show it to you, show it to me. You give me a set of this, I'm going to find you a set of this CNM, which is the only thing that's not determined. Right? That's the claim. So if I have all the matrix element, I can give you all the coefficient, you can construct that operator in that precise way. And very good. So Weinberg says, well, let's just take n and the m goes to zero. Says there's nothing there. You always want to go from the simplest case, and he says, isn't that very nice? They just erase everything here, and the only thing left is this. And you wonder how to get this. What? So that's the goal. And the method, what we have, the ingredients is O00. And O00 is by definition O in the middle of the vacuum. And now you throw O in the middle of vacuum. You can see as if it has anything here, it's going to annihilate the right vacuum. Have anything here, it's going to annihilate to the left vacuum. So they can't have anything. And you happily conclude. And then, if you are somebody hasty like me, I will conclude, oh, all the O, M, and M, it will be just equals to C and M. That's turned out not the case. So the next step of a mathematics proof is to make some induction. Says he and L is some future things I need to compute, but I'm going to assume somehow I'm given the answers whenever it's below k and L. That's our induction. And then this very beautiful, hopefully, I can see it because it's not mine. This is Ali's method. I'm going to actually do it. What I'm going to do, well, this is right. So this is, so the left is K sandwiched O in the right, and you have L. And these are number, there are K particles and there are L particles. Okay. I think this is the last step. I just want to briefly show you why my silly belief is not right. Like when I see Weinberg's proof, it's like, why do you need induction? So what I want to do is get C11 still easy enough. What do we have is O11. Some particle state, I'll just write the momentum. It's quite sloppy here. Instead of, you know, the rightful label of a momentum of spin, I'll just write the moment. Briefly, we're in scalar QFT, except that we don't have fields. But now, if I put whatever O is, well, first step, recipe. First step one is use our idea of the creation annihilation operator and turn them into something nicer, which still has O in the middle. And now I can say if the O never was there, it's just if O takes O 0, 0, it's just a number, this will yield some non-zero thing, right? You just swap them, you get some commutator out of it. But also, it's clear if you have a pair here, which is denoted a dagger, some Q1 and a Q2, this will be also work. So that is O, that's C11. So, okay. So I'm saying, so the result of this evaluating will pick out two terms. One term is nothing is there, that's C00. And one thing is has one pair there, and that's C11. So my point is, it's not just C11. C00 also contribute. So it's not really that I can just claim OKL, oh, that's just CKL. That's going to be a false. Yeah? So now we're going to do it for the general case. Step one is still nice. That's step one. I said there is L creation operator on the right to create this and the K creation operator on the left. And now we need to throw this O thing in it. So for whatever we have, it's going to have a sequence of this. A number could be zero, but let's see This is the number of a dagger, and this is the number of a. So what am I saying? Is this is crazy. With all these summations, I'll just take a typical term, and then it's gonna come with this c number of dagger number of a. Yeah. Okay. Now, question for you. We're looking for some condition such this expression does not vanish. What do you think? When would they not vanish? Yeah?
Like the number of a dagger is the same?
They need to be the same, otherwise there's going to be a leftover and it's going to either annihilate this way or annihilate this way. That's what we don't want. So the first condition is daggers needs to equals not daggers. What are the other condition? Is there any boundary on, like, can they take however many eight daggers and throw it in? Maybe look at this one. Can I just take this however many number of A's? Would that be okay? L is okay, still okay, but can you take like even one more? You can't, right? There are L's there. It's like I create an L particle. Now I come in and says, I'm annihilating L plus one. That's just not gonna work. So this one is bounded by L. And similarly, left vacuum is always weird to think about it, but what do you think this one is bounded by? Okay. And then you were like, I've done it. I have already assumed for any of these cases, okay, maybe I should put it like an equal sign there. Equal is also fine. It's the next one that's the problem. So here is a but now I see if it's smaller, I have already done it. And if it's equal, that's the CKL I'm looking for. So the idea is this thing is only contributed by CKL and all the other lower beings, like this guy. You just keep taking down a pair, right? You know, if you don't take on a pair, you're going to violate this. Okay, that's enough. So this is true. As long as you have an operator, any operator you want, you can do this expansion. Okay, so let's back to our goal. Our goal is compute, I forgot how I...
CKL minus one terms like that.
Huh? What?
Because you said CKL and then you went to CK minus one, L minus one.
Because this one says that they have to be dropping simultaneously.
Yeah. Also CKL minus one, stuff like that.
Yeah, my claim is that's not gonna work. If this works with that, that's not gonna work. It tells you have to simultaneously take them down. It's a pair, like, right? It's this condition. Tell us that they always have to be decreasing by pairs. Okay, so let's be a little less ambitious. This time ordering, blah, blah, blah. Let's be less ambitious. Let's just say that we have some V of T, or maybe it could be even more, so like V of T1, V of T2, V of T3. My claim is, okay, this is really not looking good. Okay, I'll write two terms. So I claim if I can compute this with any sequence of V, go however you know expansion you want me expand, it's exponential. Then, well, in principle, you get that thing, get our goal. Well, in reality, you get some expansion. And this expansion you have seen already in QFT. Right? It's called the perturbative expansion. Why not? It's not something unique to QFT. When actually, it's not unique to anything. It's like for any physics, we can't do it like harmonic oscillator expand. That's all we do. And then, you know, there are the few people working on the non-perturbative things, which is very remarkable and very hard. But this is my claim. If I know how to do this, for any number of Vs get a squeeze in between, then I must be somehow, well, then I know how to do that perturbatively. Okay. So then I claim the next line. I'll start writing, but kind of think about it because I have some questions for you. And I'm writing in a very sloppy way. It's very sloppy. Don't worry about the subscriptions. Okay, then I claim that any expression like that will turn some into something like this. Or some sum, some singular, some coefficients, but I don't care. I know how to do those. I know how to sum, I know how to do integrals, I know how to multiply the coefficients back. What is in the center of the piece of this calculation is that thing. So I'm going to say, what is this? Vacuum. Yeah, you all agree this is the vacuum? Fantastic. What's this? What?
An excited state.
It's an excited state, but if I want to relate it to the thing we come from, this is beta. Okay. That is weird. We'll come back to that. And this is?
Vacuum.
And this is alpha. What is this?
In the middle, the V is used.
Well, I write it this way and write some dot, dot, dots. These dot, dots hides a lot of things. But what is this? Oh, sorry, I just didn't hear you.
Is it like a normal ordering of what's inside there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is this, right? Because Weinberg says V is an operator. It must be able to expand this way. So this is the V's Weinberg expansion. And so what is this dot, dot, dot?
Sorry, am I missing something? Did we prove that claim?
Yeah, induction. We did induction proof. I said, given this, I'll find this. I found it. No, it's not like there exists the expansion. Weinberg says, no, I found it. Not only exists, but actually solved. Right? That's what he solved. He says, you can get this. Assume you got that, then he says, I can get that. I mean, normally that's how induction works. So yes, so what are these then? What are these dot, dot, dot? So this stands for VT1. What would be this starts then? With the other V's, I don't bother to write it down, but they are definitely there because you have done many problems that when you do the linear expansion and scatter and pull to vanish, right? That's not a guarantee to be the leading order. Well, it is leading order, but sometimes it vanish.
Sorry,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So if we have like a V,
yeah,
and it maybe it's not necessarily at first written out in like a normal ordered way.
No,
so
that but
the
yeah, exactly.
To normal order. Yeah. Change it to normal order. Yeah. We're gonna have some, I don't know, like commutators left over.
Yeah, that's right.
And what do we do with the commutators?
Well, you
disappeared.
Yeah, I know, but what I'm trying to say is this. Is it going to plus some commutator? But this is something we know.
Okay.
Right? Plus something we know, which is when you're doing all this normal ordering thing, to turn that into ladder form. And of course, there's going to be all these commutators. But we know commutators. It's some. It's not some really long thing, right? But it's known. So the only thing unknown, that's what I'm claiming, the only thing unknown is.
Sorry,
Gal. Yep. Oh, just like if you write down your Hamiltonian, they are not a normal order. You can normal order so that
one of the V's can be already written that way. Like,
that's right. So there are two approach. I will write down my V, normal order it to get that. But there is the other approach that says I write on a V and we keep whatever in place and you plug it in, then at you just do the normal ordering whichever step you want. There is a step at doing at this, or you can do the step that. Like the claim every operator is normal ordered like this is not the essential part of the claim. The claim is just that this O can be expanded, like a Taylor expanded in a diagram A. So yeah.
But in case that, for example, you are dealing with a Hamiltonian that is dependent on time, how do you know that normal ordering and time ordering, how do they behave with the model? Like, does the ordering procedure commute with the time ordering?
It doesn't have to, right? Because you know how time ordering works. You know what normal ordering works. Then we're just going to do that. So first you write down the time ordered things. Then the time order goes away because you already did all time order. And after you write this thing down, you're like, it's not normal order. Then you can normal order because they're not done simultaneously. So you can, it's a very good point. Is the thing is that they separate. Step one, expand S, do time order as told. And the step two, well, step two, drop time order because I did it. Step three, and we'll do normal order. See, this is transition. There's a transition step so that you can do both. You know, if you want to do it simultaneously, there's going to be conflict. It says, I want to be time ordered. The other one says, I want to be normal ordered. Then they might not be wanting the same thing. But for in this case, they are. They don't have to, right? You can do this. That's all this expression is asking to us, is time order each individual term. And once it's time ordered, you can happily just throw the T away. Okay. So very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You wrote that we need commutators for. Did you mean that you need commutators for V's?
It's either we don't need when you go through this step, you already did it.
Because you said any operator can be written in that normal ordered way.
That's right.
So, that doesn't
mean
any commutators.
It just means that your set of CKLs are different from the others. If you insist on not normal order that, that just means your set of these CKLs are going to be different from the others.
How did we prove that any operator can be written that way? I mean, I knew nobody took like
from the induction
CKLs.
Yeah.
But why does that mean like those are necessarily exactly describing?
Because we did it to the infinity.
But
if you make a claim that this goes to infinity, yeah, you're done.
Like, I don't know, what if
no, you have an equivalent way of writing this by commutator back, but then you are not going to get the same set of CLM. What I'm saying is that's fine, that's perfectly fine. But this one is so pretty, right?
So what is the commutator thing that you just in the plus commutator?
Is that you don't want to normal order that. If you get a different set of CKL, these commutators are somewhere. You either do it now, you can't hide it. You either say, I'm going to normal order my thing. Then you spit out some commutators, and then you have some sort of a CKL. So okay, two approach. Proof is what Weinberg does. Weinberg says normal order, and it's fine because we are going to do within the single V. There's no time. The time is all the same, right? The step you can never do. And then you stick into this thing, and you get that. You have normal order, you find some CKL. Okay, and you got that thing. And the other order says is not Weinberg. And you say, I don't on normal order. And you get some CKL. And of course, it's not going to be the same with those. And then you stick into this. It's not even true that you still need to normal order. Do you need it? I don't think so. The point is, the whole point is that this thing that it looks hopelessly to find now become a string of creation annihilation operator. And if these are not normal order, doesn't matter, because the point is we know how to evaluate a string of creation annihilation operator. If they are not ordered, normal order to be pretty, we still know how to evaluate them. So the point, that's my claim.
Then if like I don't understand something about time ordering now. Like the whole point of time ordering is that at the end of the day we want to be able to write this scattering amplitude or our Hamiltonian is in a normal ordered way, right?
I don't know. You might
put the time ordering there because we want to convert this Hamiltonian to a normal ordered thing. At least that's how I understood the procedure. Like, what's the point of time ordering then?
I don't know if it's a point of a time ordering. For me, it's just a good way to write it. Because you definitely could write every single expansion as when you solve, remember that the recursive integral equation, and just never put them together. For me, at this point, the time ordering, you just make it pretty. I have no fields. So I have no idea what the time ordering is going to do for me. Time ordering, for what it does for me is to write that expression pretty. And I don't even have to start with the time order. My argument, it doesn't change if you have the time ordering or not, right? At this point, we introduce that because it looks pretty, and then you realize if you put it that way, special relativity has some demands.
Without time ordering here, like you can write your calculate your scattering amplitudes without
why not
time ordering at all.
Why not?
Isn't it from
yeah. The way, of course, if you introduce time ordering, then causality just jump into your face. But if I say I'm going to write every single expansion, a single term of expansion as something has no time ordering, of course that's true. Remember, you have to prove this term plus that term, and integrate it this way, integrate that way to introduce the time order. Like you did something very convoluted to introduce it. Well, one reason to the very naive reason to introduce is, look, the expression is very pretty. Second reason to introduce is, for me, after you introduce the time ordering, then you realize causality jumps in your face. You have time ordering, you better deal with the space-like things. And if time ordering is going to give you a normal ordering Hamiltonian, wait. It isn't the time ordering and normal ordering. The difference is weak contraction.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so it didn't give us a normal ordering, right? It's because we want to compute the weak contraction. And they both show up as, if you subtract them, you get the weak contraction. I don't really think, if time ordering gave you normal ordering, that's just, the difference should be zero. Then we have no weak contraction.
At the level of this argument, we don't even need to consider the time ordering, do we?
That's what I said. You could have go back to that really long expression about it. I'm sure you have seen it in Bindiya's course, because I saw the thing. It's like you have this integral to solve, then you do recursively, you have one term, two term, three term. If you never introduce time order, this argument of course holds. That's what I'm going to say. The time ordering is very convenient, but you can just write out everything term by term.
Then what happens to your argument about causality?
It's a hint, right? It's a hint, right? What I'm saying is, it's an emergent time ordering. It seems that you need this time ordering if you want to consider all the terms. And this emergent time ordering seems to suggest that you have to have causality. It's like you can write a series of terms, it still works. It doesn't mean that this doesn't work. As long as this works, you need a causality. Yeah.
So for free field theory, I agree that the multi-particle state is well by the product of the single particles.
But everything is free, right? Remember, we have the asymptotic states. We do some observing and we push them to free particle. We have some other asymptotic states on the other side. You push them to the free particle. And then at this moment, we only have free particles. We have never had a state. At this moment, we don't have any state that it has any interaction.
So is the claim that the set of free particle states forms mm-hmm. of spans the Hilbert space, even in the interacting case?
Mm-hmm. Because you can push the interacting ones back to the free, right? Using the time evolution operator. We can talk about time ordering afterwards, okay? Because I want to break here, but there's an important thing I want to show you before we break. So here, Weinberg says, I'll give you some prescription. So clearly this thing can be calculated by doing a bunch of commutator relationships. We know how to calculate that. The only thing we do is just commute, and pick up this dense normalization thing, and we're done. And the Weinberg jumps out, says, I'll give you a recipe such that, but at this point you'd be like, okay, in principle computable, but I have to do it case by case. This seems very crazy, isn't it, Weinberg? Weinberg says, no. This is what you do. You draw a time flowing, and you put some inertial particles on the bottom. And you put some particles, final particles on top. I kind of draw minus infinity, infinity, but. So we're living in position space now. Okay? This is literally where these particles are located. And suppose I'm interested in the process that has two V's. I hope my dots are hard enough for you to see? And here, Lemberg says, well, if you ever,
phew. It's very challenging.
No, that's just very challenging. This guy, if you ever commuted an initial dagger with a V annihilation operator, and Weber says, if you ever done that, you should connect the initial point with the V. So suppose there are two things doing that. And then Weinberg says, wow, there is also these, this final state A. They could commute with this A dagger from the V. Well, you certainly can. So this is the second type of line we are prescribed to draw. So this is the third type one. Weinberg says it could also be everything in between somehow disappeared, and then there's this operator end up commuting with that, the initial and the final, and there is no V. And I'll draw a wavy line. This is the third prescription. And the next one, it says, wait, but I have a bunch of A dagger and A here. Why shouldn't I switch those two? And this is the first type. And the last thing one group points out is there's a V here. There's some other V there. Why can't I swap something in between them? And this. Right?
Wait, so we got all these lines from all the possible swaps?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what do you recognize this thing as? The Feynman diagram. This is crazy, isn't it? We have no field. It's not a quantum field theory. But in order to make our life of swapping operators to be easier, turns out we need a Feynman diagram. I don't know the rules, but there's some rules exist to map this with that. I mean, come on, there gotta be some rules, right? I can check Weinberg again, but I think when they first show up, it doesn't come with rules, and later maybe there. The final diagrams, isn't this amazing? And so, I think I'll stop here and have the break. I just want to add a piece here. And I don't know how to add a piece. Yes. Okay, here. Safe's lecture. We want to calculate the S matrix, but we found some Feynman diagram. And we'll restart. Oh, 42, I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, back. But I just want to use this to point, because I don't know if I want to grow that at all. Okay, so I'll try to say this again. Weinberg says, sometimes when evaluating this expression, I want to swap this A dagger to some A in the V. Because you want to bring the A to the right. So then, this is of course only one sample diagram. In this particular diagram I choose, that there are two lines doing this. Getting from initial state to some V. from initial state to some v. And one book says, but on the other hand, there is also an advantage to swap that a in alpha and that a dagger in v, because it's the same idea. You bring a dagger to the left. So that gave you this label, the number two line. And then Wallenberg says, there's also an advantage to bring this A all the way over here because it's an A. So you can swap the A in alpha and A dagger in beta. And that's this line, also known as nothing happens. There's no interaction. And then the next line is that you can swap within a V, and you have A and A dagger. You might want to swap them for some reason. And then that's this line. And then there is the last case, thinking about this is a V, this is a V. Then there might be something coming from the V going to the something going to the other V. So there is going to be a connection. So Wallenberg says, well, okay, probably this is probably going to be true, that this is going to work. I'm just going to draw some Feynman diagrams and use some method, which I have to look into the book if it exists. I think I don't remember seeing it. But anyway, this is fundamentally possible, because if you go back to field theory, if you think about it, instead of doing this weak contraction, instead you're going to do mode expression of all field. Of course, that's what you get. Radio exactly, yeah.
So you said that we that loop.
Yeah.
Switching within.
I know. I just realized that what Wallenberg does when he stuck that thing in, maybe he is using the other case. Is the the respite? Yeah. I just realized. So that's very good. I will double check, because when I said it, I was like, why? All right. So very good. What am I trying to get out of this? Except to showing that QFT has a Feynman diagram, and the QFT also don't have, non-QFT also have Feynman diagram. It's cute, but where am I getting? So my claim is then I have some particles, and I'm going to ask you a question. Connected, that's why I introduced the diagrams. Otherwise, to introduce the concept of connected will take like at least half a lecture. So, but it's in the notes. Now just say, wow, we have a diagram. Now I'm clear. I know what's connected, right? And what's not connected. So my question is, this is not related to that diagram. I'm just saying that if I have a connected diagram, do you know anything about this? Do you know anything result in a scattering matrix in your connected diagram when all your information is connected to the diagram? What do you have?
Wait, I'm confused about the question.
The question is, given a scattering amplitude that I told you it's coming from a connected diagram, what do you know about it? Even forget about the connected. Just give you any Feynman diagram with anything. What do you know when you know nothing about the theory, nothing about the field? Exactly, right? Even if we know nothing, we still know something. And that something is that no matter how you evaluate this scattering amplitude, you're bound to find this. It's just always there, because momentum is conserved. even without the special relativity. But then now, of course, we have four momentums. And here, Weinberg make a claim. The claim is that if it's a connected diagram, it's going to be multiplied by some stuff. That's not a claim. That's my claim. It's always multiplied by some stuff. But here is Weinberg, and they make a very interesting claim. It says, cannot have any more four momentum derivative. You got a one. That's the momentum conservation. That's it. So let me just rephrase that. And it says, what he says is no such thing such as this. It's like a subset of P and a subset of P prime, but it's not all of them. And he says this four, three, I can't remember. That's if it's connected.
So
basically, see, there's a set of M momentum. You pick some random ones. There is a set of N momentum, and you pick some. And that kind of delta would not exist in the scattering amplitude if it's a connected diagram. It's kind of a mouthful to absorb, right? It's like, why can't I have a subset of momentum conservation? What if it beats that?
Sorry, I don't or anything, but I think that the left hand side should be M, the left one and the right one should be N because the primes are.
That's
N.
Right. No, it definitely matters. It's just, I'm not very, I don't know. It's just like I make a mistake. Okay, yes. So a priori, why would we be able to make a claim that those stuff doesn't have singularity in momentum anymore? No, this is not as simple at all. But
when you say singularity in momentum, do you mean conservation of momentum?
I don't mean conservation of momentum. I mean the singular delta thing.
Okay.
Because delta is something single.
So
sorry.
We have overall, but we don't have individual pieces.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bunch of virtual particles. Does that have anything to do with this or no?
Let me try to lead you to this. Well, thank
you.
If it's a connected diagram, you have that.
Connected diagrams, you could have delta.
That's why. This is the only claim, only. That's why that I need to introduce the idea of connected by drawing you a diagram. Otherwise, I wouldn't even have to do that, right? Yeah. The claim is if it's connected, no more that.
So you're saying that there are no loops?
Loops? What loops?
If you have, if you have something like the, like the fourth thing that we draw, that would be like a,
but they are at the vertex, right? The claim is about the claim is about the initial and the final. Yeah, you can have whatever you want in between. The claim is only regarding the initial and the final. After all, that's the physical information we have. In between is just, everybody's imagining it.
But how would anyone why is it a question? Because you can't guarantee that you would have, momentum conserved. You are assuming that all particles that can interact could possibly have the chance of interacting. So why would we even think that we would need to set aside, these top two particles will have momentum conservation with these top two, but the others.
The claim sometimes it's intuitive. The question is, how do you prove it? How do you put a nail on the coffin on it? It's kind of intuitive. Well, here is Weinberg's approach. This part I was really enjoying because David has taught you a lot of What did David taught you like 5 times?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. See? And now we have this, right? What another theorem tell us? Okay, I'm just going to write, suppose I have this. So 2, 3, 2 prime. See, they are, suppose that's, oh, okay. No, the other set. This set is not helping me because they are disconnected. Oh, the other set. I'm not choosing my. Okay, can you bear with me that this is somewhat disconnected, but it's okay. It's like it's not a complete, like because of the inclusion of 2, it's not a completely disconnected with the rest of it. Okay. So that's an example. And wait, sorry.
Is not for that diagram, is it?
It is.
That's disconnected.
It's not, because the 2 is included. You have to drag the 2 around. 2 is connected. So some subset of this set, it's not completely disconnected. But some would say at here, it gets connected, right? To the rest of the graph.
P3 and P2 prime are.
Yeah, those two. So the claim is yes, this is allowed because it's completely disconnected. So basically, I'm defining the connected as the opposite of a completely disconnected. So if it's not a completely disconnected, then it's a somewhat connected. And Weinberg's claim is even it's somewhat connected, that's not a good idea.
It's completely disconnected.
See, if you take look at 2 prime and 3, if I take those 2 points, throw onto the Mars, same diagram, right? It will be complete. No, the Mars example will come back. But the point, see, there is, you can draw a line and separate it into 2 diagrams. Then each of those 2 will be completely disconnected, because they can be separate if it's connected. So for example, this you can't draw a line, because if you draw any line, you're gonna cut that let. Okay? So the connected and the disconnected is really defined by the line that separate them. If you can separate them, you get a disconnected diagram. If you can't, then you don't.
So this is a disconnected
diagram? It's not. How do you separate the 2 from the rest? You have to cut a line there, right? You kind of cut the lines.
Disconnected was the 2 prime and 3 are disconnected from the rest.
That's right. That's right. So that's what I meant. This one is disconnected, but when you include 2, it's no longer disconnected. So the other way to define connected is, remember, so okay, my blobs are back. All the blobs stand for disconnected diagram, and if you pick a diagram, you pick some dots that are not completely within one blob. If you pick it up completely in one blob, that's disconnected. But if you pick 4 dots from 2 different blob, then it's not disconnected. So this is some Feynman diagram there. Some Feynman diagram here. I might not contribute, but who cares? But my point is, these are all disconnected diagram. But if you put a point, pick a point here, and pick a point there, then it's not disconnected.
How do you define the blobs here? Like, what are the blobs?
By the lines that can separate the blobs.
Any kind of separation or
whatever? Like any kind of a separation, as long as your line does not cut through the diagram. Like, if you have a line that like this, that's not allowed. Don't do that. So for example, in my example right here, I temporarily lowered it down. That's the line. And I claim you can't find another line like that. Then, this is connected, this is the other connected diagram. Anything else you should do is probably not connected. But, no, this is disconnected from that, that is disconnected from this. Anything you do is going to be connected. Okay, let's come back to my exciting point. Let me make my exciting point. So David taught you about the Noether theorem. So what does David say about this data?
Symmetry.
What a kind of
symmetry? Translation symmetry.
Translation symmetry. So here is what Weinberg believe is that if they have such a translation symmetry, then I can do this. See, connected, still connected. You can try to separate them, but they are connected by this line. Right? This is what a translation symmetry tells us. And what do you mean by symmetry?
Nothing changed.
So this new, very weird diagram needs to be equals to SO. But now I'm going to make a claim. My claim, so I was about to draw that part on the Mars, but you see I have constraints. But that's what I meant. It's in the Mars or in China, as far away from us as possible. That's all possible because we have translation symmetry. No. Oh, okay, one way, you're not going to be happy with my explanation now, but one way is that if you have a QFT and you evaluate a propagator value, you can take some limit and you will realize the scatter amplitude. Then you with that kind of propagator, it's going to be very small. So I'm not very happy with the answer too, because we don't have QFT. So here is a very interesting thing. The claim, one more claim. The claim is in such a diagram, and it has to be on this board. On that board, it's not true anymore. The claim is this diagram. Has to evaluate it to zero. You pay very attention of this subscript. I'm only considering the scatter amplitude of this one, which is connected, because now I include the two. Why? Right? This is a very interesting thing. So this is somehow called a cluster. Fine. I'm not going to argue about their naming system. I don't like it. And this is another cluster. And then the claim is that if you have clusters, then you must have the cluster decomposition principle says that it's going to be factorized. Okay, this cluster decomposition principle, you can say I don't really like the name, but what did they say? If you put the first cluster in lab, I don't know, our lab somewhere. We don't have a lab. IQC. And that one throw it in China. Then our physicist's intuition says, well, our results had better be independent of each other so I can repeat my experiment and get the same result and show that I'm a physicist, not a string theorist. I can make fun of a string theorist because I did string cosmology, right? Yeah. I'm making fun of myself, that's allowed. Okay, but the point is, there is a, so this is this so-called cluster decomposition principle, which has nothing to do with special relativity or quantum mechanics. It's really a principle that any physics must respect this because it's regarding, you know, different labs, you can repeat your experiment, blah, blah, blah. Then there is an exciting footnote. Show that they are equivalent. Very exciting footnote show. These two claims are equivalent. So now we have a trouble, right? The trouble is the cluster decomposition principle, or the lab thing, tells me that this scattering amplitude needs to be zero. And why is it bad? What did we previously say about the scattering amplitude? Remember, there is another theorem, translation symmetry.
Don't we want it to be zero because we're trying to say that we can't have that sort of delta function?
No, well, we assume this exists. Right? This is our assumption. Assume this exists. And we're trying to say, what do we get? And the way we just get is that this cluster decomposition principle trying to claim the amplitude is zero. But what did we previously claim by doing all this translation stuff? We have a translation symmetry, right? What does symmetry tell?
Scattering amplitude should attend.
Yeah. First, grab your favorite diagram. That is called old, which is not zero. And now, you do this. Translation symmetry means they gotta be stay the same. But as soon as you separated them far enough, the cluster decomposition principle comes in and says it's zero. Well, non-zero is not zero. Hence, we have right? We have a contradiction. And hence, we prove that this claim says, okay, it's just one delta. There's nothing in the stuff if you have a connected diagram. And hopefully this agrees with your experience. Right? That's how you experience in QFT. Is that, okay, so I'm going to do this is so here is what we know is the for a connected diagram which from my point of view those are the only interesting ones anyway that we can do a counting. And you might have counted it before, but I'll show you there's a little difference. So now from a graph, I can count, right? Each of this V, well, I have no knowledge of V, so it contributes X number of delta. So X times V will tell me how many delta coming from the vertex. And if you have some internal lines, you're going to use your delta to, so to speak, fix the momentum. So, but then you have to add the loop back. But what we know is this thing has to be one. This is what Weinberger's decomposition principle tells us. Is I don't care what's going on in the graph, but in the end, there's only one left.
Wait, Don, I'm a little confused. Okay, so first we define x as the number of deltas. Why did we set it equal to v of t?
Sorry. So I just meant that each contributes, because I don't know how many contributes. I don't know the number. I know it's an integer.
But then the xv there, is that a different v?
That's the number. Sorry, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, that's crazy notation. That's the potential, and this is the number of vertex, number of internal lines, and number of loops. Right?
We're trying to
evaluate this diagram and say if it's a completely general diagram, how many delta function we should have.
An each internal line gives us a delta in each loop?
No, the each internal line will give me mass minus one
delta. Oh, minus one delta.
Right, because back in your QFT, you can use a delta to fix the internal.
Oh.
It's like the very, by doing that, I was thinking of this, right? There's one, two, three, four, and then you can fix this. And when you fix, you use the delta. It's not going to, like that delta show up in the middle, but it's not going to go reach the bottom of the calculation.
I don't quite understand this because we didn't actually, we haven't actually written down the.
No, I didn't. I'm just saying.
But
exactly. But I think
the loops give us integrals and internal lines take away the integrals. We're basically writing what we had for Feynman diagrams in QFT.
That's right.
For something that we haven't defined.
But your QFT, if you expand every field in mode expansion, it's for this. This is the more fundamental thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what works for QFT has to work for that. Remember QFT. Okay, let's do QFT. Phi square. Apply the some a something like this plus a dagger something like that, some integrals, you stick it them all in, and all the rest you extract all the factors. All you have left a bunch of accretion and Lagrange operators.
So, looking at the deltas were vanishing because of the LSC.
Delta cannot vanish. Delta turns some momentum into some other momentum. Okay.
So,
I'm
so vanishing.
There is this thing, and then you compute, you claim this thing is this. By doing that, you use the delta.
Why do you increase the
loop? Because the loop has the free momentum thing. That I can't do it right now, but the leech loop. You basically the idea is you are fixing both internal lines, but those are not independent because they're in the loop. So you actually did something wrong. Like you have it's like overcounting the internal line, and then you have to pick up the loop back. Okay. So yes.
Can you explain how we get that relation?
Okay, so let's look at this. The claim is that V contributes some number of delta, which I don't know, it's X. But this is exactly the same way, V. So if this contributed X, then this has to be contributing X. If I have another V, it has to contribute to X. So all the delta we have to start with has to be delta times the X times V. V is the number of the vertex. Right? So now, look at this thing.
The same number of contributions.
Look at this thing. You write down the internal momentum is something. But then you use some vertex. See, all this momentum are, say, going into the vertex, and you use momentum conservation, and you fix that internal momentum. During which you basically effectively it's something like you would be in your calculation, what you're doing is that you do something like this. Okay, that's not gonna work that well, but you use the ladder to get this, right?
Why wouldn't we ever have, like, why could X be different from one? Like, shouldn't each vertex have like give us one delta because we have like the incoming momenta and the outgoing momenta? Yes, but we say X is the number of deltas per vertex.
Yeah, but see, that's the interpretation from the QFT, is that there's the right that you use the QFT.
So this is more general?
Yeah, we still have no fields.
But then how would you know that you couldn't get a different number of deltas from different vertices?
Because it's the same V.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly the same, right?
Okay.
We're just expanding that thing. So what come out has to be the same.
Right.
Okay. This is very interesting.
Yeah, so again, function we have. Okay, I don't know exactly if what I'm saying makes any sense at all, but can the potential change in a way so that it has more A daggers and A's, and sometimes it doesn't? Because if it has, because
but how do you how like if you agree with that, the thing we're calculating, how could you expand this get something not V? If I'm doing exponential of something and I'm expanding it, how could, like, if there is only V on the exponent, how could I expect to get some other thing, something other than V?
Not something other than V. I mean, V changing in time.
But
so VT1 has like 5 A's and A daggers, and VT2 has 7 A's and A daggers. I don't know if this is true at all, or how that would make sense, but I'm just.
Okay. I'll think about it.
Yes.
But
you have 5 A daggers, 5 A's, and then you have 7 A daggers and 7 A's.
I'll think about it. Okay. So the point is that we're going to arrive at this bounded by our expectation from a theory like this, from a diagram point of view, these are fixed. But the only problem we have is this, and this is fixed by the cluster decomposition principle. And as you properly have done it in field theory, once you arrive at this, you are forced to choose x. Because this is some graph theory thing. This thing has nothing to do with physics. Usually you can just count the vertex, count the internal lines. I can explain why from graph theory that's just true. Like it has nothing. Huh? So x equals to 1. Just
the formula downstairs.
This whole thing equals 1 because this argument. I only get 1/3.
Formula from graph theory, should it be equal to 1?
That's definitely true. Okay, I can talk about this graph theory thing later, but the point is we somehow arrived at what you learn from the field theory, that V can only contain 1 delta, and that's exactly the delta that it, but like the momentum conservation. And hence, I'll just draw random things. So hence, this is the square that I call the CDP, cluster decomposition principle. And you can see, now things get very constrained, right? You're looking for a puzzle piece that has to agree with our previous discovery and the causality, which is the causality and the CDP. That's one Berger makes a claim. Actually, he has some reasons. So a lot of people is actually working for alternative of QFT. And one Berger looks at them, what they're trying to do is write down some scattering amplitude that agrees with special relativity. It turns out, at least by the time one Berger write his book, those things will not produce we will not produce a single delta for V. So this is the result is V contains 1 delta. And that's when Weinberg says, oh, maybe there is something more than the fact that fields works. Maybe it's a fate. So I'll explain more, a little bit more, why fields, why do we really need it? Well, that's Weinberger's argument, is that people have written down theory that it works with special relativity and quantum mechanics, and if you check them, they don't decompose it. They don't have this factorization thing. And then Weinberger says, oh, maybe, you know, field is inevitable. On the other hand, they also stumble on random reference claim that they have solved this problem. They have the other theory, and it's 200-page reference, so I didn't read it. But my claim is that their theory must be not as practical. Like there are some essential things are not essential, but even practical purpose things that they are just not as good as. So I think the current claim is that there exists alternative, but this thing is so good. And as a conclusion of the class, I will see that, there's nothing but to stop us from the right QFT there. Hence, I conclude my puzzle, but Friday we'll really asking a lot of whys. For example, why this theory doesn't work? This is a perfectly good theory. I write down the theory and I can compute, I can get a scatter and amplitude. Why don't we stick with this?
Violates
the other theory? No, it doesn't. This is the as long as you don't random stick these things in your scattering amplitude, you're perfectly fine.
Should time be bad? Actually, the time operator can't be that little over time. I think it's on the.
There's nothing wrong with that theory. The only thing wrong with that theory, it's very hard to actually practically use it. So
I'm stopping.
Stop.